It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Thousands flee following Boko Haram attack in northeast Nigeria. Libyan fighting shifts from Tripoli's airport to Benghazi. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. A Nigerian official now says more than 15,000 people have fled an area in the country's northeast following an attack by the Islamist group Boko Haram. Residents in Damboa say militants entered the town Friday, killing scores of people and burning down homes. The exact death toll is unknown. In South Sudan, fighting for control of the town of Nasir in Upper Nile State continued Monday between government forces who control the town's center near the Ethiopian border and rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar. It's seen as the most serious fighting since the two sides pledged in May to honor a ceasefire reached in January. In a statement Monday, the United States condemned the rebel assault on Nasir, saying the town's residents have suffered from frequent and horrific acts of violence and human rights abuses since the conflict erupted in December. It warned of famine conditions looming, making it urgent that both parties recommit themselves to inclusive political negotiations. Meanwhile, Reuters reports a delegation of South Sudanese rebels is to meet today in Kampala with President Yoweri Museveni to ask him to withdraw troops from South Sudan. They were sent there to bolster the government. A Ugandan foreign ministry spokesman says the talks will be generally about a way to find the way out of the current impasse in the peace process. In Libya, fighting is centered around the country's second-largest city, Benghazi, Monday, where as many as 16 may have been killed after Islamist militia attacked an army base. The violence came a week after a week of fighting between rival militia for control of the Tripoli International Airport, in which nearly 50 were killed and dozens wounded. The country's transport minister, Abdel Kadir Mohamed Ahmed, toured the airport Monday, pointing to a burned-out Airbus A330 jet that belonged to Afriqiya Airlines. He says it will cost more than $100 million and up to 5 years to replace it. Meanwhile, analysts quoted by the French press agency say liberal factions appear poised to take over Libya's embattled parliament following results of last month's election. The results issued Monday, but the future of the makeup of the parliament will be determined by the formation of political blocs. In Liberia, the homes and businesses of many people on the coast have been swept away by rising sea levels. As Jennifer Lazuta reports, the government is trying to slow the effects of sea erosion.
Hundreds of coastal communities in Liberia are being destroyed by sea erosion. Residents say they are left homeless as rising sea levels continue to wash away their houses and shops. Joe Muffer lives in Grand Bassa County's Buchanan City, one of several areas that have been badly affected by the erosion.
Well, the situation is terrible. The sea erosion has taken away our homes. Right now, I have to relocate my family to an abandoned school building.
Liberia's Environmental Protection Agency is aware of the problems the rising sea levels are causing and has been working to control the erosion. Stephen Y. Nufville is the Deputy Executive Director of the EPA. Nufville said the Ministry of Lands, Mines, and Energy has spent $6 million on various projects throughout the country. He said $2.4 million is being spent on the ongoing Phase 1, which is constructing offshore seawalls to help stop the waves from further eroding the shore. But Liberia's Steering Committee on Sea Erosion estimates that at least $18 million will be needed to complete the project. Residents, meanwhile, have been building protective sandbag barriers in front of their homes to keep the seawater at bay. But for many, this has not been enough. Jennifer Lazuta for VOA News, Dakar.
As thousands of delegates to the 20th International AIDS Conference are in Melbourne, Australia, examining the current state of AIDS research, a medical journal reports anti-AIDS drugs have helped save 19 million years of human life since 1996. The Lancet reports the UN estimate of HIV deaths and disease has been overstated by about 25% following last year's UN AIDS report. The analysis has been tracked by a team of international researchers who looked at the rates of new infections, deaths, and numbers living with HIV, tuberculosis, and malaria in nearly 190 countries between 1990 and 2013. In Sudan, at least 27 people killed Monday when a bus and a truck collided south of Khartoum in White Nile State. Zimbabwe, the government is cutting its stake in the country's stock market to attract more foreign capital. The country is struggling with a liquidity crunch and massive unemployment. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 22nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The long-awaited meeting between Nigeria's president and parents of the kidnapped schoolgirls will take place today, Tuesday.
Government continues to reassure the parents and other stakeholders that, look, government is committed to one major objective: to ensure that the girls are brought back home safely and that in these and other matters, the terrorists do not prevail.
Ruben Abate is the spokesman for Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan. Malawians are angry with their parliamentarians for giving themselves a huge pay raise. And South Sudan women demand a say in the country's faltering peace process.
There is a gap between the women at the higher level and the grassroots women. Now we are going to plan for a meeting between these women who used to go to Addis Ababa and want to discuss with them face to face and see a way forward.
Jean Gordon is the chairperson of the Women's Network for Peace and Reconciliation. The United Nations demands Ukrainian rebels give access to the site where Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 was shut down, and celebrating African-American contribution to the U.S. Civil War. Those stories plus Marco Oman Sports and our Listener of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The long-awaited meeting between Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan and parents of the kidnapped schoolgirls is expected to take place today, Tuesday. Presidential spokesman Ruben Abate tells reporter Peter Clotty that President Jonathan will reassure the parents and community leaders from Chibok of his administration's commitment to return safely the over 200 schoolgirls abducted by the Islamist militant group Boko Haram.
Something that the president had always wanted. You know that the president had made efforts initially to meet with various stakeholders from Chibok and from the northeastern part of the country. The president also set up, after April 14, a fact-finding committee which visited Chibok. But it then happened that during that visit by the fact-finding committee, the parents refused to meet with that committee. And since then, the president had been looking for an opportunity to sit down together, you know, with the parents directly, and with the girls themselves, the ones that have escaped, to reassure them of the government's commitment, to empathize with them, and to, you know, bring them up to date about the efforts being made by the administration to ensure that the girls are brought back home safely. The meeting is scheduled for 11 a.m., and, you know, the president is looking forward to it.
The Bring Back Our Girls campaign, as well as some parents of the Chibok girls, have said that information about government efforts to look for these girls and bring them back home appear to be limited, and they appear to be frustrated over 90 days since these girls were abducted. How do you respond to such concerns?
The government has since set up a national information center which provides information on a daily basis. And then you also have the Directorate of Defense Information, which keeps everybody up to date on a daily basis. Whatever criticisms, you know, may be thrown in the direction of government is understandable because, you know, people are pained, they feel pain. People are feeling a sense of outrage because what we're dealing with here is human lives. It's an assault. Terrorism is an assault on human freedom. So the expectation, of course, on the part of the parents will be that, look, they want quick results, okay? But, you know, government continues to reassure the parents and other stakeholders that, look, government is committed to one major objective: to ensure that the girls are brought back home safely and that in these and other matters, the terrorists do not prevail, that evil does not prevail.
Dr. Abate, one question people keep asking, especially Nigerians that I have spoken to, appear to say, does the government know where these girls are?
The security forces know where the girls are being kept. But, you know, he also cautioned at the time that they cannot give too much details because they don't want to turn the girls into cannon fodder. But that he wanted to reassure everyone that every step will be taken to ensure that the girls are brought back home safely. What everybody must realize is that, yes, the concern is understandable. The extent of the outrage, there can be no limit to it. It's all understandable. But at the same time, you know, the security forces have made it clear that they cannot provide such information that will empower the terrorists.
Ruben Abate is the spokesman for Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. A Malawi human rights campaigner says a decision by the country's parliament to give itself a pay raise of nearly 100% is a disgrace and inconsistent with the expectations of the people. Report quoting finance, ministry and parliamentary sources said under the new arrangement, the basic salary of an MP will go from about 180,000 kwachas to 250,000 kwachas. Their consolidated allowances will double from 544,000 kwachas to 1.1 million kwachas a month. Billy Banda is executive director of Malawi Watch, a non-governmental organization advocating for human rights and good governance. He tells me the parliamentarians are putting their own selfish interest above the national interest.
It's very regrettable because Malawi as a country, we are ridden by so much burden in terms of the country has a huge debt. And the current leadership of the DPP is living in huge promises that people are highly expectant. And the members of the National Assembly are not meeting the expectations of the electorate because everyone is expecting that the legislators are there to understand that the 50 years of our country, the poverty levels is beyond major. And there is need that members of the National Assembly should not have looked for their personal interest, but rather they should have been expectant to fulfill the expectation which they pledged and promised to the electorate.
When we talk about this 100% pay raise, about how much are we talking about? Compare that to what the members of parliament used to get and what they are voting for now.
As we are talking today, the current wage bill, we are talking of per month, is going beyond almost 2 billion Malawi kwacha. And if you calculate it perhaps per year, it goes maybe to a big amount of money, perhaps going beyond maybe 16 billion, which is worse than what perhaps the citizenry sector, maybe the economy can afford. The debt level that Malawi has is beyond measure, and we needed to tighten our belts, not put our selfish interests to look into our own selfish means or selfish gains.
The members of parliament have also voted themselves a raise in their allowances, including housing, constituency, and vehicle maintenance allowance. I was looking at the vehicle maintenance allowance, which has jumped from kwacha 150,000 to 600,000 kwacha a month.
On that note, the members of the National Assembly are looking into their own personal interest, not looking into the interest of the ordinary citizen. I am calling it selfish interest because a normal thinking person who shares the grief of a common citizen would not have pushed for his or her own personal interest.
What can members of the population do? What can Malawians do? What are your options?
The best way to do is to lobby with the president to engage members of the National Assembly to reschedule, to change their attitude so that their interests should not be above the interests of many other ordinary citizens, and also understand that when they were coming into the seat of the being honorable member, they made huge promises back, and they are there to sustain the interests and expectations of the voter.
Billy Banda is executive director of Malawi Watch, a non-governmental organization. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lilongwe. South Sudanese women's rights activists say the country's leaders have failed to bring the seven-month-old civil war to an end and as a result deepened ethnic divisions. As Philip Aliu reports from Juba, the women are demanding a voice in the peace process from this point forward.
About 200 women from an umbrella group of women's organizations told members of the National Platform for Peace and Reconciliation in Juba that thousands of South Sudanese women and children lost their lives and thousands of others continue to suffer in IDP camps, but the delegates to the talk in Addis Ababa do not seem to care. They say it is only when women are included in the talks that unique gender concerns and concrete steps toward peace building will actually come to fruition in South Sudan. Jane Gordon, chairperson of the Women Network for Peace and Reconciliation, says the conflict has created hatred among South Sudanese ethnic communities. Gordon says women can restore peace and harmony to the nation. She says representatives of the women group hope to convey that message to President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar in person.
They said enough is enough. They don't want any fight. They wanted to meet President, and they wanted also to meet Riek, if possible. If they fail, they wanted to meet their wives because they are the ones suffering and they wanted to talk to these ladies, to talk to their husbands, that we don't want war anymore. Okay, there is a mistake between children as a mother. Children can fight. You come back and reconcile and let us go ahead with our development. Because we don't want to hear any guns at night. We don't want to even to run anywhere.
Gordon says women whose husbands and children are paying the ultimate price on the battlefields also when their voices hurt.
There is a gap between the women at the higher level and the grassroots women. We are going to plan for meeting between these women who used to go to Addis Ababa together and want to discuss with them face to face and see a way forward.
Gordon says the Grassroots Women Network for Peace and Reconciliation will be visiting internally displaced persons in camp to convey their message to other women, especially mothers nursing babies in difficult conditions. Women rights activist Guliba Florian Akim says she believes lasting peace will only be achieved at home if South Sudanese own the talks.
Peace will never be achieved in Addis. We can achieve peace in South Sudan, back in our localities where we are coming from. We believe as women, we are not fighting. It's the men fighting. Because these are our husbands, these are our sons, these are our relatives who are fighting. But as women, when we come together, we'll be able to unify these men.
The women say they will work with the National Platform for Peace and Reconciliation, and they will contact their members of parliament. But they will also continue to demand more representation at the negotiating table in Addis Ababa to try to achieve lasting peace in the country. For BOA News, I am Philip Aleu in Juba.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 22nd. Daybreak Africa time is 16 and a half minutes past the hour. President Robert Mugabe came under attack Monday from the opposition and ordinary Zimbabweans after claiming that the country's declining economy has started to improve. Mr. Mugabe's ruling ZANU-PF party had been criticized for failing to fulfill its 2013 election promise to deliver jobs. Douglas Wanzora, spokesman for former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai's MDC party, accused Mr. Mugabe of being out of step with the nation.
We are extremely astounded by what President Mugabe has said, that Zimbabwe's economy is on the mend. We do not know which Zimbabwe he's talking about. Maybe he's talking about his neighborhood in the Borodale, but the rest of Zimbabwe are suffering. There are no jobs, there is no good service delivery at all, and there is a lot of poverty that has manifested itself in Zimbabwe. So there is certainly no sign that the economy is on the mend. The industries are still closed, the factories are closed, the shops are closed. There is massive deflation in Zimbabwe. So we do not know which economy he is talking about, but certainly if it is Zimbabwe, then he is not right. And we are not surprised that President Mugabe can talk like that because he's extremely isolated, and we suspect that he may slowly be turning senile because the economy is totally, totally bad. Civil servants are not being paid, and there are no definite salary just for civil servants. How then can a president say such an economy is on the mend?
Douglas Wanzora is the spokesman for former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai's MDC party. ZANU-PF spokesman Urugare Gombo defended President Mugabe's claims, saying, indeed, the economy was on the mend.
Well, that's the MDC mantra. They always talk about Zimbabwean economy not performing well. Theirs is to criticize. They have nothing to offer on the ground. They were with us for 5 years. They didn't do anything tangible. Now that we are involved in trying to turn around the economy, they jump up and start moaning and growling about this. It doesn't help. The key thing is that we must look at the economy itself and say, are we doing well or not? If we started doing better than we were doing last time, the answer is yes. The president is correct. He sits right at the top there. He sees what is on the ground. Reports coming from ministries, reports coming from various institutions, companies, paracetals, and so on. The governor of the Reserve Bank is on record that, the economy is improving, is showing signs of improvement. The banking sector is sound and stable. Banks have declared profits. Some of these things were not happening during the unity GNU. Those things were not happening. So these things are happening. Obviously, economic turnaround and the economy, it takes quite a bit of time. It's not going to be an overnight transformation of the economy.
Rugare Gombo is the spokesman for President Robert Mugabe's ruling ZANU-PF party. The UN Security Council unanimously demanded on Monday that armed groups controlling the crash site in eastern Ukraine, where Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 went down immediately, allow safe and unrestricted access to the wreckage. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir has more.
The Council strongly condemned the downing of the aircraft and called for a full, thorough and independent international investigation. Council member Australia, which had 37 nationals aboard the flight, drafted the resolution. Foreign Minister Julie Bishop traveled to New York for the vote. She said Russia, which backs the separatists, must use its influence to ensure the resolution is implemented.
We must have answers. We must have justice. We owe it to the victims and their families to determine what happened and who was responsible.
The Malaysian airliner was downed over eastern Ukraine on Thursday, killing all 298 passengers and crew aboard. Since then, rebels have controlled access to the crash site. There have been reports of evidence and even victims' possessions being removed. U.S. Ambassador Samantha Power said a resolution should not have been necessary.
We welcome Russia's support for today's resolution, but no resolution would have been necessary had Russia used its leverage with the separatists on Thursday, getting them to lay down their arms and leave the site to international experts, or on Friday, or on Saturday, or even yesterday.
The United States says flight MH17 was likely downed by a surface-to-air missile operated from a separatist-held location in eastern Ukraine. Officials have said because of the specialized knowledge required to operate the system, they could not rule out that Russian personnel had provided technical help to the rebels. Russia has blamed Ukraine for the crash. After some changes were made to the draft text, Russia supported the resolution. Ambassador Vitaly Churkin said an impartial and independent international investigation is necessary, and the International Civil Aviation Organization should play a leading role in it. He said all evidence, including the jet's black box recorders, should be provided to investigators. 189 of the plane's 298 passengers were Dutch nationals, and Ukraine has asked the Netherlands to lead the investigation. Dutch Foreign Minister Frans Timmermans came to New York for the vote. In emotion-filled remarks, he condemned reports of bodies being moved and their possessions looted. He said a political game has been played with the victims' remains. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Their exploits were little known by most of the public in the decades after they fought. But toward the end of the 20th century, more attention began to be paid to the African Americans who fought for the Union during the U.S. Civil War. In 1862, African Americans, both free and escaped slaves, were allowed to enlist in the Federal Army. 179,000 served during the conflict, and many believed their service was a major turning point in the war. One of those black regiments was recently recognized for its contributions, and VOA was there to share the story.
The participation of African Americans in the U.S. Civil War was made popular to the world in the 1989 theatrical release, Glory.
Fire! Load!
With the participation of Civil War reenactors, the U.S. National Park Service recognized the 23rd USCT, the first black regiment to fight in direct combat with the Confederate Army of Northern Virginia.
To come here today and to gather on this spot, really for the first time, the first ever public event, public recognition of this place and its role in history, I just couldn't imagine a more appropriate ending to this beautiful day than that.
The 23rd fought bravely and victoriously at the Battle of the Wilderness in Spotsylvania on May 15, 1864. These men escaped from slavery and gathered in camps in and around Washington, D.C. from 1863 to 1864. From there, they were recruited into the Union Army of the Potomac and formed the 23rd. They returned to the place of their enslavement to free those friends and families they were forced to leave behind.
But the first significant battle that they were in was here. The 2nd Ohio was going to reach out for help. The only help available is the 4th Division of the 9th Corps. The 4th Division are all U.S. colored troops. And then they will fire on Thomas Ross's Cavalry Brigade and drive them away.
The reenactors not only added a sense of authenticity to the event, but they were also historians themselves. They were able to answer questions like, how did the black regiments stand up to the expectations of the white troops?
They had no idea what these former slaves could do. They had no idea if they would fight or run. So from their perspective, I can kind of understand it, but they had to earn the trust. And the USCT, the more they earned that trust, the more they took part in battles and all, that trust grew. And it grew into legend and grew into greater glory.
The reasons for war will always be debated, but the sacrifice and bravery of those who fought and died must always be acknowledged.
I ain't got long to stay here. No, no.
It's 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Egypt edged Congo-Brazzaville 1-0. Ethiopia and Gabon drew 0-0, as did Togo and Senegal in Orange Africa Under-17 Championship qualifiers on Sunday. In other matches, Zambia pipped Botswana 1-0. Ivory Coast outplayed Libya 4-0. Cameroon dismissed Burkina Faso 2-0. Mozambique edged Angola 2-1. Benin pipped Mali 1-0. Uganda thrashed Rwanda 4-0. And South Africa and Tanzania drew 0-0. While the Confederation of African Football postponed the clash between the Democratic Republic of Congo and FIFA Under-17 World Cup champions Nigeria by a week. In Algeria, Frenchman Christian Goukaf takes charge as Algerian Desert Fox coach, the Algeria Football Federation revealed in Algiers. He is assigned to guide Algeria to glory at the 2015 and 2017 Orange Africa Cup of Nations, as well as qualifying the Desert Fox for the 2018 FIFA World Cup in Russia. In Switzerland, Angola and Swaziland are Africa's most improved national teams, while Cape Verde Islands has slipped by the widest margin, according to the latest FIFA rankings released in Zurich. Algeria's Desert Fox are Africa's highest-placed team, in 24th place, one spot ahead of Ivory Coast. African champions Nigeria are 34th, Egypt 36th, Ghana 38th, Tunisia 42nd, Guinea 51st, Cameroon 53rd, Burkina Faso 58th, and Mali 60th. Meanwhile, Tunisia's under-23 side challenge their hosts Qatar in Doha today, Tuesday. Both sides are preparing for the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympic qualifiers. In athletics, Kenya's Job Koech Kinyor and Collins Cheboi triumphed in the 800 meters and 1500 meters respectively at the IWF World Challenge meet in Madrid, Spain on Saturday. Stacy Chepkemoi Ndiwa and Purity Cherotich Rionoripo ensured a Kenyan 1-2 triumph in women's 3000 meters. On the infield, Egyptian Mustafa Al-Gamel was runner-up in hammer throw, as South African Godfrey Kotso-Mokwena was third in long jump. Finally, in rugby, hosts Kenya dismissed Uganda 34-0 to win the senior men's contest with a 48-21 aggregate in the two-leg Elgon Cup in Nairobi on Saturday. Kenya beat Uganda 27-12 to triumph in the men's under-19 contest with a 37-27 aggregate, while the Kenyan women outplayed their Ugandan peers 39-10 to prevail on a 72-25 aggregate. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a great day. Here's our listener mail for this Tuesday morning, July 22nd.
I wish to use your medium to call on President and future Nigeria government to shun abuse of profession in Nigeria. This call became very necessary because in Nigeria, someone who reads medicine and surgery can be given appointment as a minister for education, where he cannot discharge efficiency, thereby causing problems to our economy. Albert Alagbo from the Department of Public Administration, Akanibi and Federal Polytechnic, Ibom State, Nigeria. Thank you.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. And that's it for this Tuesday, July 22nd edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Butte in Washington. Have a great day.
Music Time in Africa offers splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. From the classics of yesteryear to the hot tracks of the moment, I offer you what you need. Free ear therapy and mind massage. Join me, I'm Heather Maxwell, for Music Time in Africa every Saturday and Sunday at 0900 2000 and 2100 UTC.